Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Checking Valley traffic, I-17 southbound. A crash at Northern has the HOV lane blocked. And on I-17 southbound in the downtown area, a crash blocks the 7th Street exit ramp. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 105. Clear skies for tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s, 103 for a high tomorrow. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, it's 106 degrees. The campaign to legalize recreational marijuana is suing the state's chief election official for what it calls errors in the ballot language. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
In court documents, attorneys for the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol say the description of the measure crafted by the Secretary of State has at least three errors. The first incorrectly states that only people over 21 years old would be able to buy and possess marijuana, when, in fact, it should be 21 years and older. Campaign spokesperson Barrett Marson says the ballot language also doesn't identify how the tax revenue would be spent.
That is a serious error of omission. This initiative taxes marijuana sales at 15%, and the majority of that money goes to education.
The third issue is the description says violations are only punishable by a fine, but the Act says some offenses are felonies as well. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Today is primary day in Arizona. Voters are deciding a number of races. Among the highlights, Arizona Senator John McCain is running against former state Senator Kelly Ward and other challengers. That's in the Republican primary. The East Valley's 5th congressional district has attracted four candidates in the GOP primary to replace the retiring Matt Salmon. And five Republicans are running in the 1st district, which includes most of eastern Arizona, in an open seat there. There are also legislative primaries and one on the GOP side for the Corporation Commission. Polls are open until 7 tonight. We'll start getting results around 8. Those watching for those numbers online will notice a new website tonight. The Secretary of State's office has enhanced its site to provide real-time results, among other improvements. Joining me to talk about that, as well as other issues primary related, is Dan Hunting, a senior policy analyst at the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. And Dan, let's start with the new website. What's the significance of it? Like, do things like this matter?
Well, they certainly matter to people that will be following the elections closely. If you are a candidate or somebody that is intensely interested in a particular issue, and you're one of those people that is staying up late, punching the refresh button to find out how the votes are coming in, it will be of interest. It obviously won't be changing the outcome of any elections that way. That's not changing voting patterns in any way. But it certainly will be a convenience on top of the already good service that the Secretary of State's office has done for years at putting data out there available to the public.
Let me ask you about today's election in general, and specifically about voter turnout. And this year has seen so many elections already, an abnormally large number of times that Arizonans have been asked to vote. I'm curious if you think that will have any kind of impact on voter turnout, the number of people who either show up at the polls today or vote early.
That's a good question. Traditionally, presidential years have a higher level of turnout, so we can expect a good turnout in November. How that plays out in the primary is a little different matter. I expect that there has been a lot of interest in some of the races, the District 5 race, the Senate race with John McCain having primary opposition. That will probably turn out some people. You never expect primary turnout to be as high as that in a general election, though.
What has been the breakdown recently of early voting versus day of voting for the primary?
I don't know the exact percentage, but it's a great majority of the vote has been early voting.
Do you think that might be even more so this year because of the long lines and sort of all the attention that what happened during the presidential preference election earlier this year got?
I think that's just a trend in general. Most people are going towards that online voting, the idea of going towards going down to your local polling place and casting your ballot is is not the way most people choose to vote these days. I think that's a general trend, regardless of what's going on, and maybe that the past problems we've had will accelerate that trend. Certainly the fact that it's August, and if you're thinking about standing outside in the heat, that's not as nice as maybe in a November general election. So that might be an effect too.
Do you think the fact that each of these different elections that we've had already has had different rules as far as who can vote, how you vote, where you can vote, will that have any kind of impact on what happens today, do you think?
I honestly don't know. Those rules can be complicated and frustrating. I think, though, that people that show up, and certainly the early voters, get mailed the ballots. So I don't think it's going to be as much of an issue with that.
Is it a problem to you that turnout for primaries is so low? I mean, should we be looking at ways to try to raise that number?
Well, I'm always a fan of increasing turnout. That's what democracy is about. However, just the reality is that primaries cater towards the people who are most engaged in one party or another. So I think that's just kind of a fact of human nature that will be with us for a while.
That was Dan Hunting, a senior policy analyst at the Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU. And be sure to stick with KJZZ for primary coverage. We'll have updates throughout the evening and special coverage starting at 9.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
And Mark, as Arizona votes on this primary election day, there is confirmation that the FBI is looking into evidence that election systems in the state were compromised by hackers. State officials claim there was no harm done. Cybersecurity experts, though, say more fortification is needed.
Yeah, the Arizona Secretary of State's office confirmed earlier this summer that their election website was briefly taken down to deal with a, quote, credible and serious threat to the voter registration system. But spokesman Matt Roberts says it was not an external threat.
We didn't find any evidence that anyone had penetrated the system at all. It was, according to those cybersecurity folks, a localized attack where a election employee downloaded a virus inadvertently.
Roberts says reinforcing cybersecurity has become a top priority for Secretary of State Michelle Reagan and officials in all 15 Arizona counties.
That is something that the secretary feels strongly should be implemented, and we're going to talk to our counties to gauge their interest.
But the question remains, could it happen again, and how vulnerable are election databases in Arizona and elsewhere? Joining us now is James Scott of the Institute for Critical Infrastructure Technology, which issued a report this week entitled Hacking Elections is Easy. So, James, how easy is it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that really stood out to us was the massive attack surface, not just with the voting machines, but the technology and the physical aspects of the democratic process. So everything from warehousing the voting machines beforehand to how easy it is to remove the seal after it's been inspected so you can inject malware in it. The black box aspect of most of the technology with the voting machines. The lackadaisical cyber hygiene and security hygiene that voting officials have that makes it so easy for social engineers and adversaries to actually get in and do some damage with an election.
The FBI had contacted Arizona to inform them that some of this information was compromised. How so, and what did they tell the state and the Secretary of State's office about how that had been compromised?
From what we can gather, the FBI contacted the state to let them know that login credentials to the database may have been compromised. So if that's the case, then there's probably a remote access Trojan, which is also known as a rat, involved. And if that's the case, then malware has been injected into the system at the PC or network level.
What type of information was hacked, as far as you can tell, from the Arizona election sites?
Yeah, from what we gather, it's things like driver's license, last four digits of the Social Security number, address. It's not difficult for an adversary to cross-reference with hospital of birth, town of birth, things like that to get the rest of the numbers for the Social Security number, which means that the state is going to most likely have some type of ID theft issue that they're going to have to confront head on.
And who is responsible for this, James? We hear a lot about foreign governments. We've heard a lot about Russia. And the conspiracy theorists would say they're trying to interfere with our elections. Is there any evidence of that from what you can tell?
I think that with Russia and China, in this case, it would be about taking confidence away from the democratic process. Our country, from an international perspective, is seen as spiraling off its axis and in chaos. But I don't necessarily think that this particular case is a state actor.
So should Arizonans going to the polls today to vote in the state primary be concerned that their information that's on those registration databases has been compromised?
We don't want to fearmonger, and we want everyone to take part in the democratic process. But moving forward, I think it's incredibly important to expect more of the election officials, that they should have some type of security training when they come into possession of data or tallied votes. And I think from a state government perspective, there needs to be more cyber hygiene.
James Scott is co-founder and a senior fellow at the Institute for Critical Infrastructure Technology. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. A municipal ID card in Phoenix is one step away from becoming a reality. The Phoenix City Council will cast its final vote on the issue tomorrow. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the move has drawn harsh criticism from some state lawmakers who are vowing to reverse the policy in the state legislature.
When Eduardo Pym isn't working, chances are good you'll find him doing something creative.
So this is the space here. This is the shirt press here. And those are poster presses.
Pym is an artist, and this screen printing studio is almost like a second home to him. While Pym does have a day job, his design work brings in the occasional paycheck, too. But actually cashing those checks is a challenge, as he often faces this scenario at the bank.
At the bank, they're asking for a state ID, which I didn't have, and they wouldn't take my school ID.
Pym grew up in Phoenix, but he's undocumented, so he can't qualify for that state-issued ID the bank was demanding, meaning he often has to go to a local liquor store that cashes checks.
Sometimes it's a little sketchy. Sometimes it feels like I'm in purgatory.
But not having an ID impacts more than just his finances. Most landlords require a state ID to rent an apartment, and for parents in Pym's position, not having an ID can mean they're not allowed inside their child's school for things like teacher conferences.
Community members asked if we could do a state identification, if we could do a license. And looking at the political makeup of the state, we were like, no, we can't do that right now.
Betty Hernandez is the executive director for the Center for Neighborhood Leadership, one of several organizations supporting the development of a municipal ID. The coalition known as One Phoenix ID introduced a more local idea to city council more than 2 years ago. They say other groups that also have trouble obtaining state IDs, like the homeless and the elderly, could benefit too.
If this identification card will not be actually respected by everyone within the city, including the Phoenix Police Department, then it would be useless, right? Because one of the biggest factors has been people not calling police because they're scared to interact, because the first question is, you know, let me see your ID.
The city also hopes to integrate the card with services like the library and light rail. And organizers are working to get museums and other cultural locations to offer discounts for cardholders. The vote Wednesday will formalize an agreement between the city and independent contractor SF Global, who will run the program. The measure has strong support, but there are some vocal opponents, too, including Councilman Jim Waring.
Bottom line, we're spending a lot of taxpayer time and money. Again, it's a serious problem, but this card is going to do absolutely nothing to solve it. And in a state that has high rates of identity theft, should we really be throwing a card out there with potentially the City of Phoenix logo?
The One Phoenix ID Coalition insists the card will be cost neutral, paid for with card fees. Local nonprofit groups have also pledged man hours to help with administrative operations. But Waring isn't buying it.
This is a federal government issue. The City of Phoenix City Council is not the group that really should be addressing it. I understand political pressure is driving this.
Municipal ID programs are already up and running in other large cities, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York City. In New York, more than 863,000 people have one. Half say it's their primary form of ID, and they've used it for a variety of reasons, including getting into a museum. The city has run into some roadblocks. Many major banks, for instance, don't accept them. Still, thousands report they've successfully opened a bank account using the ID. The measure still faces challenges from Arizona lawmakers, though, like State Senator John Kavanaugh. He introduced a bill earlier this year that would have blocked a city or town's ability to establish a local ID card like this. He says identity theft is his main concern, but
I also don't believe that people who are in the country illegally should also be assisted in circumventing laws.
It failed in the Senate by one vote, but Kavanaugh says there's always next session. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. Brazil's suspended president, Dilma Rousseff, went before the Senate and maintained her innocence in a country that has accused her of moving funds between government budgets with the skill of an Olympic gymnast to hide Brazil's deficit. Rousseff also called the trial illegitimate.
I'm absolutely sure in relation to my acts as the President of the Republic, and I am personally here before those who are judging me. I am going to look in your eyes, and I will say with the serenity of someone who has nothing to hide that I haven't committed any crimes against budget responsibility.
The Senate is expected to vote this week on whether to permanently remove Rousseff from office. Two-thirds of the Senate must find her guilty. If it's a less than two-thirds vote, though, she will be reinstated. Alex Quadros is a reporter and author of Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. He returned from Rio de Janeiro in July, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I watch the Olympics. I watch what goes on in Brazil. I mean, people are riveted to their televisions on this political controversy. And the tone of lawmakers even gives it a sense of history in the making. There's a certain gravitas. But there's also a sense in Brazil that this is just a bunch of jokers here going through the motions of something that we have no faith in. How can both of those be kind of true?
Well, I think it's important to understand, first of all, that Brazil has only been a democracy for three decades. In the mid-80s, it emerged from a two-decade military dictatorship. So the institutions are maturing. It's as stable as I think it's ever been as a democracy. But it's not, a country like the United States with more than 200 years of consolidated democracy. And during several parts of the impeachment process, I think there have been legitimate questions about whether due process is being followed. When it was the lower house of Congress's turn to decide on the president's impeachment, it really was a circus-like atmosphere with congressmen citing God and their families and the fight against communism, which I think everyone had thought had been decided sometime in the past as their reasons for impeachment. The proceedings right now in the Senate have been a bit more sober. They seem to be seriously focused on the technical questions at hand, which is whether she violated budget rules.
Does the sense of the Olympics having transpired without some obvious global fiasco, American swimmers notwithstanding, does that give more confidence to either the people of Brazil, the lawmakers of Brazil, the institutions of Brazil in this moment?
Well, it's interesting that Dilma's impeachment is happening right now, right after the Olympics have ended. And this is intentional. The impeachment calendar purposely took account of the Olympics because it would have just been too surreal and embarrassing for the country to be impeaching its president while the whole world is watching and the Olympics are going on. You know, I think the fact that the Olympics went off without much of a hitch, at least in terms of organization or, violence when it comes to tourists and athletes, I think that gives the impression that the event was a success. But I also think that it pushes into the background the really serious questions about how much this event cost to the country and to the city. And the fact is that Rio is now on the verge of bankruptcy.
Well, that's the question. Is this a powder keg in Rio? Is the pressure building nationally? And, you know, if we were talking 5 years ago, Brazil could do no wrong. It was the fastest growing economy in the developing world by far. Has it squandered that growth in a mass of Petrobras oil corruption and political misbehavior that we're seeing right now?
Well, it really is amazing the contrast between the Brazil that was in the headlines, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago and the Brazil that we see today. I arrived in the country in 2010, and this euphoria about the country's economic prospects was palpable not only in the foreign headlines, but really inside the country. People were optimistic about the future in a way that I don't think that they ever had been before, at least on that scale, because, you know, it's a country that has been through lots of booms and busts, but this is the first boom that the poor also shared in the gains. And more than 30 million people were lifted from extreme poverty, in part because of the economic growth, in part because of welfare programs. And, you know, I think what's important to realize now is that by the same token that the optimism and the euphoria was probably over the top back in 2010 or so, I think the pessimism may be overdone now. And people are acting like, you know, it's going to be the next Venezuela or something.
And but that's incorrect.
This is absolutely incorrect. It's a country of 200 million people with a diverse economy. The institutions don't always function in a very pretty way, but they do essentially function.
Alex Quadros is a reporter and author of Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. A bill pending in the U.S. Senate would curtail the exporting and sale of items sacred to American Indian tribes. This has been an issue with some items going to auction in France. The Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony or STOP Act would increase penalties under an existing law that aims to get items back to the tribes to whom they belong. Joining me with more on this is Peter Pillis, the forest archaeologist for the Coconino National Forest. And Peter, first off, what is the STOP Act and how would it be different than what's currently in federal law?
Well, as I understand it, you know, what it would do is that it would make it illegal for anybody to take an object of what we tend to call cultural patrimony and, you know, sell it or take it outside the borders of the United States. There is no such provision right now, unless it was an object, say, that would also be defined as an archaeological artifact under the definitions of the Archaeological Resources Protection Act.
I want to ask you about definitions, because it seems like that is somewhat of a gray area as far as what is defined as something that you can sell or export and what you cannot.
Exactly. That, I think, is one of the most difficult aspects of the proposed law, is how that will be defined. For example, if somebody makes a replica of what is considered to be a ceremonial object, is that covered by the Act? I think some tribal people would say that would be. There are also differences of opinion within the tribal communities about who has the authority to make decisions involving the disposition of traditional items. Some of it is on the basis of individuals, who, as well as others who have specific offices in certain religious societies or clan organizations. And I can see that differing, you know, from, say, village to village, you know, group to group.
How big of a problem is this that we're still dealing with in the year 2016?
I really don't know the exact magnitude of it. I do know, however, that it continues to go on, and it is a matter of extreme concern to many tribal groups.
From your perspective, is it as big a problem in this country as it is overseas? I mean, we hear so much about auctions going on, for example, in France. I mean, is it more of an overseas problem, or is it also an issue here?
It would be an issue here. I think the main thing is that they have made it so public in France. The trafficking that goes on in this country is pretty much, I think, under the table, so to speak, and it isn't brought into the public purview to the extent that it has been in the sales in France.
So I know you don't obviously have a crystal ball, but if this bill were to go into effect, how big of a dent do you think that it could potentially put into this problem?
It would depend upon what resources were put, you know, to promote and to pursue the law. As I mentioned, you know, the sale of, you know, sacred items is going on, you know, today. What is needed is the funding and the personnel to be able to investigate and track down these kinds of sales if such a law is going to be enforced. So it would be the funding that would be provided for the enforcement of the law that would be the important part of it.
How easy or difficult is it to find and track down and authenticate some of these items?
It tends to be quite difficult in the sense of, as I said, that the trafficking in sacred items like that is something that is done, you know, in the dark. You know, it is not something that is done in broad view to the public. So it's done by, you know, shady characters. It's done by people that would take tribal members, get them drunk, and get them to, you know, sell them objects. It's used by dealing with people with drug problems, once again, to steal the items that they would have access to sell them, you know, to support drug habits. So it's the kind of thing that is going to be difficult without a lot of investigation to be able to track something down. In terms of authenticating it, you know, that should be fairly simple, which is to ask the religious practitioners of the specific group involved if it is or if it isn't. But there have been cases where even that has been challenged by people in court.
Peter Pillis is the forest archaeologist for the Coconino National Forest. Peter, thanks.
Quite welcome.
America's opiate epidemic has been well documented, and Arizona is not immune from that. But public health officials are working on ways to combat the problem and some of the underlying issues as well. Joining me to talk about that is Dr. Ben Bobrow. He's a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. He's also the medical director for the Bureau of Emergency Medical Services and Trauma System that's in the state health department. And Ben, how do you balance the needs of people who have legitimate non-cancer chronic pain with the need to prevent medications from ultimately being abused?
Right. That's really where the tension lies. Our job as a healthcare system and healthcare providers is to alleviate pain and suffering. That's the number one thing we're supposed to do. And what sort of happened in the 90s, we had this big swing in the pendulum, and we basically thought we should use more and more opiate medications to try to alleviate all pain. And I believe we went too far. And now we kind of have the consequences of that, which are we have millions of people across the country that are actually addicted to opiate medications, and it has lots and lots of terrible side effects.
So how do you swing that pendulum back?
Yeah, so it's part of the public conversation, letting people, you know, understand we really have two epidemics. One is the opiate overdose epidemic, but we have another epidemic that's sort of in parallel and I think related, and that's the epidemic of chronic pain. You know, we have more people disabled from chronic pain today in the United States than ever before. We're making huge headway in other major public health problems like heart disease and cancer and lung disease, but in chronic pain, we're actually not improving despite using more and more drugs and more surgeries. And so, you know, we have to figure out exactly why that is. One of the reasons I think that may be is that we're focusing so much on trying to alleviate all pain using medications, and we're sort of forgetting some of the basic things that maybe we learned when we were young and our parents told us about staying active, staying positive, not worrying too much about pain, some basic things like that.
Could it really be just as simple as like changing your attitude and making sure to stay hydrated and get enough rest and all that stuff?
Well, I don't want to make it sound simple because I think part of it is attitude in that, you know, we've kind of become a society where we think we can cure all pain, where the reality is we really can't. In fact, you know, pain is sort of part of our life. And a big part of chronic pain is how you approach your pain. When you get pain, if it devastates you and it changes your life and it changes your day and you start to view yourself as an injured person and you kind of fall apart, that's a really, really bad thing. Yet, other people that have really painful conditions can be really positive and they focus not on what they can't do, but they focus on what they can do.
What kind of research is going on to try to figure out ways to treat people who do have chronic pain, but treat them in a way that can't be abused, isn't habit forming necessarily, and maybe won't turn into the kind of problem that we've seen with opiates?
Right. So what we're seeing more and more is that an approach of just focusing on pills or just focusing on surgery or nerve blocks, things just like that, it's not working. We have to focus on more of what we call the biopsychosocial aspect. So not just the physical, but also what's happening with the entire person and their life and their family and their surroundings and helping them understand all that. Because pain has an enormous emotional component. And so helping people understand how that works will get us a lot further than just, for example, prescribing pain pills.
In listening to you describe some of the side effects, I'm hearing like 5 or 6 different fields of medicine all at once dealing with one person. I mean, are medical professionals from different fields really working together on this to try to come up with like a holistic solution here?
More and more people are working on approaching, the holistic approach. But still, our system, one of the challenges of our system is we're very siloed. We have a lot of different silos. We have specialists for everything. We need to really back away from that. Of course, these specialists do wonderful work, but we need to approach the entire person to help them get better.
Is that happening?
I think it's happening more and more. People are seeing the potential. And really, frankly, what we're seeing is that our current system isn't doing its job. And when we compare ourselves with other industrialized countries, we're actually falling further and further behind in things like disability and chronic pain.
In your mind, are we at a point in this opiate epidemic yet where things are not necessarily getting better, but they're maybe not getting worse? They've kind of plateaued and health professionals can kind of get their hands around the project and at least start the process of getting it better?
I do believe that with all the attention the federal government, the state governments, health departments have put on the opiate, they've shined a huge amount of light on the opiate epidemic. But, another question that I know people are asking, well, if I can't take these drugs that I'm used to taking, well, then what? What else do I do? And so that's sort of the next conversation is what else can people do to actually get better?
Ben Bobrow is the medical director for the Bureau of Emergency Medical Services and Trauma System in the State Health Department. He's also a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. Every year for the past 25 years, the Princeton Review has been putting out a book ranking what it says are the country's best colleges in a wide variety of categories, from great financial aid to happiest students to party schools. But one way you will not see them rank colleges is from best to the worst.
I do think that the idea of a hierarchical ranking list, you will never see this from the Princeton Review, schools ranked 1 to 1,001, and I just don't think it's very helpful.
Rob Franek is Senior Vice President of the College Admissions and Testing Company and the author of their annual college rankings. He says instead they focus on how a school can be the best fit for each student. Today they're releasing their newest list of rankings, the best 381 colleges. And the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with him about this year's rankings. And Lauren, how did Arizona schools rank this year?
Arizona State University, the University of Arizona, and Prescott College made the list. So the U of A was ranked number 2 on the list of colleges with the best health services, and it also made the lists Students Pack the Stadium and Best Athletic Facilities. And Prescott College, a small liberal arts school, was ranked on a few different lists, like Nobody Plays plays intramural sports? Is that a dorm? And this is a library?
Those are actually lists, huh?
Right.
So how does Princeton Review determine which colleges make these lists?
Well, Franek says they get the best information from the experts.
We go directly to whom we would consider college experts, current college students, and asking them about their experiences academically, campus culture, financial aid, career services, basically anything that should affect a student's quality of life inside or outside of the classroom.
So Franek told me they surveyed 143,000 students this year, asking them to report on their school's academics, its administration, life at the school, and on other students. So I wondered, why 381 schools?
The real answer is that myself, our full editorial team here at the Princeton Review, don't back into the number of schools that we're going to profile in the book each year. All of these schools are academically superlative, but they're not always the most competitive schools in the country. We're certainly writing about each of the Ivies, but we wanted to keep the lens very wide because our goal at Princeton Review is to make sure that students are finding a school that's going to be the best fit for them, academically or otherwise. So we wanted to make sure that we had a wide lens, hence the 381 schools that are in the book.
Sure. So ASU was always, for a long time there, seemed to be ranked as one of the top party schools, not this time around, it looks like. But why rank something like party schools? Does that kind of weigh on what students and parents need to make a decision about a place?
I do think it's important to know what your experience is going to be, certainly inside the classroom and outside the classroom. And we do have a party school list, one of those 62 top 20 ranking lists. But that said, I think it's important because you're probably not, as a college-bound student or a parent or even a guidance counselor that's helping them along the way, you're probably not going to hear about the active social scene in a college view book or in marketing information created by the school. But you should know, without question, that there's an active social scene at any of the schools in our top 20 party school list. And that's why we're putting that information out there, to make sure that students and parents know full well that these schools are exceptional schools academically, but if there's an active social scene at that school, we want them to know that as well.
Yeah, okay. So you've been doing these rankings for 25 years at Princeton Review now. What have you seen kind of change over time, both in terms of like how you do the methodology of these surveys and then also in what students are telling you?
When we think about how our methodology has changed, it has remained so consistent over these 25 years consecutively and going directly to current college students and asking them their experiences. What has changed, however, is I think student taste. More and more students and parents have become, bullish around asking things that would have been taboo, honestly, just 5 or 6 years ago. The idea of return on your investment, the idea of saying, hey, I'm ready to make the academic sacrifice. Myself and my family are ready to make the financial sacrifice, but we want to know that there's going to be great value for us. And that's where we've been trying to focus on internships, career services, financial aid. I mean, how aggressively is a school trying to bring down that sticker cost of that school to make it affordable for the average kid and family? If I were to say in a nutshell, that's what has changed dramatically over these last years.
Do you think that's just because the price of college is going up so much?
Undeniably, cost of college has continued to rise every year consecutively, 2 to 3 percentage points past the rate of inflation every year consecutively for the last 20. So without question, we know that there's math behind that. But I also think there's so much spotlight on the issue of paying for college and that idea of how much debt a student is going to take over, just from the media in general, that I think it's just on students and parents' minds.
So do you think, looking at this 25 years of doing this survey, do you think the notion of how to pick a college for a student is changing?
That's an excellent question. I do think that so many students now understand that their goal is finding fit. And I think helping them define what fit is an important role. And I feel like we do a very competent job in that regard at Princeton Review, saying, listen, fit cannot just mean the hardest school to get into or the easiest school to get into. It has to be a great fit for you academically. You want to make sure that you're going to be challenged and engaged in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But you also want to make sure that you're going to be happy in your life outside a classroom. And that could be anywhere from diversity issues on campus. Are gay students on campus accepted? Are they not accepted? All of those things we have as ranking list and then narrative at that school. So you can go in understanding, what your typical experience is going to be. And I do think that has delightfully changed over the last years.
All right. Well, Rob Franek with the Princeton Review, thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for the time.
As floods in Baton Rouge remind us, weather and climate can have devastating impacts on our cities. To try to mitigate those effects, a group of scientists from 17 institutions around the U.S. and Latin America are trying to figure out ways to build more resilient infrastructure. The effort is based focusing on 10 cities, six of which are in the U.S., including Phoenix. Chuck Redman is the founding director of ASU's School of Sustainability and the co-director of the Urban Resilience Sustainability Research Network. And Chuck, will the answers be different depending on the issues faced by particular cities? So, like, would planners in one city handle floods differently than those in Phoenix deal with heat?
Oh, absolutely, they're going to be different. And importantly, they may actually be in conflict. Take an interesting example. Phoenix is threatened by, and we are experiencing heat, and we're threatened by greater heat in the future. But we're also facing droughts and long-term water shortage. But quite frankly, we can cool our city by landscaping it with shade trees and more green. You know, notice when you walk across a lawn, it's cooler than when you get back on the sidewalk. Well, there's a cost to those lawns and those trees, and we're in competition for drinking water, swimming pools, golf courses, farming. All these things need water, yet we want to maybe use a lot of that water both to produce electricity and to directly produce landscaping that cools our homes and our commercial areas.
You referenced lawns and landscaping and other kinds of things like that. We've also heard about experiments with green asphalt on parking lots. We've heard about trying to put some kind of landscaping on the roofs of buildings. These are things that have sort of been around for a while. Are those the kinds of ideas you're looking at, or are you looking for something new here?
Well, there's certainly a lot to be learned already from things that are being attempted, like green roofs and in particular permeable pavement and things like this. And on the other hand, they don't always work well in every situation. And I have to tell you that green roofs, as exciting as they are in a number of our partner cities, haven't always been that productive here in Phoenix. Particularly the buildings aren't built for the load. When in snow country, they're built for heavier loads than our roofs. Solutions in one city are not always solutions in another. And so we are looking for what we would call green infrastructure solutions, but we're looking for really new approaches to it. And we're going to try to help local decision makers by really setting up a cost benefit.
Are there any potential answers to dealing with the heat in Phoenix that maybe they're just now in the experimental stage, but ones that you're particularly excited about, things that you think hold real promise?
The heat in particular, and I'm a great Phoenix area booster, but we are threatened. And the heat and long-term changes in heat, I think, are a serious concern. And part of the answer is the old answer, and that's electricity. So there's a whole series of issues on the power end. Then there's this whole series of issues about shade and plants and the cooling effect of plants, and I think it's tremendously important. And then there is the issue of materials, our cement, our asphalt. Do we make it permeable? Do we make it so it has certain better cooling characteristics? Do we make reflection on buildings? Yes, but also that's a problem for other people in the area. I think we're going to be looking at skins on buildings that produce electricity and don't reflect but don't absorb. It's going to have to be, there'll be a lot of technology in here, but a lot of also reorienting of behavior and priorities. And the last thing that we want to make sure we don't miss is that a lot of these solutions cost money, and they end up getting differentially implemented across our city so that some people are left out. And I think it's really important in planning for a resilient future city that we make sure that we're building it for all people in the city and not just for the people who can afford an extra tax or can afford to pay a fee in their development.
I'm curious about the cost element, and I'm wondering, when you're looking at potential answers here, how do you balance the technology of it? Will it work? How efficient will it be? Versus the financial aspect, how much will it cost? Will people actually be able to afford to do this?
Well, I don't think there's a simple formula for that, but I think it's got to be out in front. But cost is an interesting question, because there's no doubt that the cost of disasters, the cost of it becoming too hot in Phoenix and people leaving, those kind of costs are extraordinary. And so what we really have to balance is, what is our investment today that protects us or yields a return in the future. Quite frankly, what we're talking about is investments today to protect you against huge costs in the future. That sounds a lot like insurance to me. And we've begun to talk to the insurance industry, and I have to tell you, they're very concerned about future climate and weather events.
How long a term project do you think this is?
When we start talking about building resilience in communities and in cities and talk about sustainability of a way of life, there's no end date for me. Building a resilient future for Phoenix and the other cities around the world, this is a long-term and part of the future of our lives, and that's how it should be.
Chuck Redman is a professor at ASU and the co-director of the Urban Resilience Sustainability Research Network. Chuck, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
For humans, sweat is a necessary nuisance. So in these dog days of summer, we asked reporter Tanya English at WHYY's The Pulse to look into the evolutionary science and psychology behind perspiration.
Bring your arms up over your head, interlock 10 fingers. Turn to the right.
The fact that you pay money to spend 90 minutes in a super hot room, working out next to a dozen other half-dressed people drenched in body fluid, that's a little ridiculous to me.
You want sweat dripping from your elbows to your knees to your toes. Hold still and release.
Laura Markevich owns Drip 105 Hot Yoga in Central Pennsylvania.
So it is 105 degrees in here and it's around 40% humidity.
Markevich says clients want her to make them sweat because modern people with our air-conditioned cars and express elevators don't have a lot of built-in chances to exert ourselves.
Back in the old days, men would go out and work all day and they'd come home soaking wet, provide for their families because they worked so hard. So it's kind of like this manifestation of our hard work, right? That's why we like sweat.
That kind of sweat is all about thermoregulation. When your temperature creeps too far above 98.6 degrees, the body's cooling system kicks on. Sweat glands send perspiration to the surface of the skin, and heat comes with it. Then evaporation draws that heat away from the body, leaving a film of cooler sweat behind. Perspiration is mostly water, plus a little salt and trace minerals. Hot yoga teacher Laura Markevich says it's pretty clean.
It doesn't have a stink, a body odor.
The perspiration that we work hard for comes from one type of sweat gland. They're called eccrine glands, and they're located all over the body, back of the knees, the forehead, even in your ears. And there's a theory that our ability to sweat gives humans an evolutionary advantage. Imagine your ancestors hunting down an antelope out on the African savanna. Sweat let them stay cool without having to stop, find shade, or pant like a dog.
We were able to actually run our prey down. And so, you know, our endurance in the middle of the day when other animals have to rest maybe served us in getting our food.
Angela Ballard is a nurse educator with the International Hyperhidrosis Society. She helps people deal with uncontrollable excessive sweat. The average person, just sitting around, loses as much as 32 ounces of sweat a day. That's enough to fill a big gulp cup. Ballard says, different from the rest of us, elite athletes start sweating sooner because their bodies are more efficient at keeping cool. So that's one kind of sweat. But there's a second kind of perspiration that we talk about less.
Get four times the protection against stress sweat with Secret Clinical Strength. Stress stinks. Stress sweat doesn't have to.
Stress sweat fuels a multi-billion dollar antiperspirant and deodorant industry.
It's thicker, it's milkier, and it's more of our fight or flight or stress sweat.
Nurse educator Angela Ballard says that kind of sweat comes from apocrine glands, which are clustered in hairy parts of the body. All sweat starts out odorless, but when it's trapped in our armpits and down in our nether regions, it's hard for perspiration to evaporate, and it's that mixture of moisture and bacteria on the skin that can create a funk. But back when we were cave dwellers, BO had a purpose.
And may have helped warn our, you know, clan mates around us that there was something to be scared of, like you could smell fear.
Instead of being triggered by temperature, apocrine glands are activated by embarrassment and anxiety, hormones and emotions. Think back to the Republican primaries. Donald Trump suggested that Senator Marco Rubio's sweatiness said something about his ability to lead.
Did you ever see a guy sweat like Rubio? I've never seen anything like
that. I do think that there's a cultural stereotype there. When we see someone sweating, it means that they're losing their cool. Literally.
That's psychologist Carissa Perry Parrish. She sees people at the Center for Sweat Disorders at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Her patients have conditions that require prescription medicine or even surgery just so they can get through the day.
Like a police officer having a hard time holding on to her firearm because of hand sweating.
Or an elementary student whose classmates won't hold hands to play Ring Around the Rosie because his hands are clammy. Perry Parrish helps her clients deal with the psychological burden of being sweaty all the time. It's a feeling she really understood the last time she went to the farmer's market in 100-degree weather.
And I had sweat rolling down my back. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so gross. So imagine feeling like that every day across every social interaction.
Her clients have real issues to deal with, but maybe the rest of us are a little too freaked out about sweat. After all, sweat is absolutely necessary and inevitable, even if you're not planning on hunting down a gazelle today. I'm Tanya English.
And Tanya's story comes to us from WHYY's The Pulse, a health and science show. The podcast is on iTunes.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.